morning, Counselor. You ready?
Yes, sir.
Please proceed.
Good morning. Gary Dubin, representing the appellant, Marie Minichino. This is actually a fairly simple case, and we appreciate the opportunity to have an oral argument. The parties entered into a DROA to my client to purchase a residential property on Maui. It had a clear financial contingency, which expired on June 25th, 2002. My client has always taken the position that she explained that she couldn't get financing, and she informed Mr. Lowe that she was therefore canceling the DROA. And that's what she did. She bought another property. Then 2 years later, Mr. Lowe sues her, claiming that she failed to close. Excuse me. And then seeks to compel arbitration, and arbitration was granted, arbitration was held. The central theme of Mr. Lowe's case, starting with the complaint, through the arbitration, and through the findings of fact of the arbitrator and his conclusions of law, was that as of June 25th, the transaction was not terminated. My client came to me after the arbitration. She had found the emails that she had sent to Mr. Lowe that specifically informed him that she couldn't get the financing. She was terminating the transaction. She requested that he stop harassing her. And then she went about her business and she bought another property. At the arbitration, which was something like 3 years after this all happened, she still couldn't find the emails. And obviously, presenting that to the arbitrator, she had no proof. As a result, the arbitrator found against her.
What was the testimony at the arbitration with respect to the termination issue or the timeliness of it?
My client continued to object to the statements by Mr. Lowe that she had not, he was claiming she had not canceled.
Did he specifically testify that he did not receive any emails or written notification of termination?
We do not have a record of the arbitration hearing.
Was it recorded, or is it not available? Or?
To my knowledge, it was not recorded.
Okay, but Mr. Dubin, here you're asking the court to vacate and remand based on fraud, correct?
Correct.
And the alleged fraud here is perjury in
correct.
The arbitration proceeding, that Mr. Lowe lied to the arbitrator when he said he didn't receive notice of cancellation, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so before we can get to a lie, we have to know what he said. And so part of what we've got to look at here, I think we all recognize that fraud is a statutory grounds for setting aside an arbitration award. The question is, what has to be proven in order to show that fraud, and was it shown in this case?
We don't have to prove perjury.
But isn't that your argument here, that it was perjury?
No. Well, the argument is fraud. One aspect of that fraud we feel is perjury. If you look at finding of fact number 12 in the arbitrator's conclusion of findings and award, it says, defendant never advised the plaintiff that she wished to terminate the purchase until sometime after July 24th, 2002. Now, what evidence could there possibly be except the testimony of Mr. Lowe? Now, I fully recognize that without the transcript, it becomes a little bit difficult to show that he specifically perjured himself.
Does her declarations or affidavits establish that that was his testimony?
I believe it does. And the motion to vacate the arbitration award, attached to that is her declaration. On paragraph 12, after she states that she had told the arbitrator that,
okay,
of the emails, it says, knowing that his testimony of the arbitrator hearing was false, the seller nevertheless lied before the arbitrator.
Okay, so there's at least a sworn declaration to that effect in the record on the motions before the trial court.
Yes, and we thought that should have been enough at least to hold an evidentiary hearing.
Okay, so that's one element. So we have that at least some evidence before the circuit court that he did lie, and you're saying that raised a question of fact. What else does your client need to show to vacate the arbitration award?
I think the whole case. In other words, you've got somebody who waits 2 years and then claims that somebody failed to close. Well, there's no dispute that there was a financing contingency. So when somebody says, sues you because you failed to close, knowing there was a financial contingency, it's implicit in that you didn't cancel within that time frame.
But isn't one of the distinctions that we have to make here, don't we have to look at why she didn't bring this before the arbitrator? Doesn't she have some burden to show that this information wasn't discoverable upon exercise of due diligence prior to or during the arbitration?
I think she was complaining about that throughout the whole case. And
Before the arbitrator or before the circuit court?
I think it's clear that she did both. Now, okay. On that issue, in a court of law, Rule 60 in the state court and Rule 60 in the federal court actually provides for setting aside a judgment, even for a mistake, inadvertent surprise, or inexcusable neglect, or newly discovered evidence in the exercise of due diligence within 1 year.
So here, I guess that's the question. What's the factual allegations, at least, that your client made to the circuit court that would establish that she exercised due diligence in attempting to find the newly discovered evidence?
Well, that's an important issue. I think in her declaration to vacate the arbitration award, she points out that she had a flood and a lot of her stuff was destroyed, and she looked and she couldn't find it, and she kept looking and looking, and finally she found the emails.
Was there any evidentiary hearing on any of those issues, or is it simply parties getting up and arguing to the court whether or not there was a due diligence or whether or not there was fraud? How did the circuit court base its ruling?
We asked for an evidentiary hearing, and it was denied.
So there's no testimony by either party or credibility determinations made by the court upon which to base its findings?
No. There was none, and that was one of the disturbing features of it, because I thought at least we'd have an opportunity to have an evidentiary hearing. I think the problem is that in recent years, there's been so many referrals to arbitration, and there's this idea afoot that it doesn't matter what happens in arbitration. It's essentially non-reviewable, and I think a lot of the judges take the position they're not going to look at what happened. And in fact, I think I've got three other cases before this court on very peculiar facts that took place during the arbitration. And we get usually the same thing from the trial judge as well. Even if there's a mistake, no matter what happened in the arbitration, you selected the arbitration, so therefore you waived any right to object. And speaking for myself and other practitioners, it's very frustrating. And in this case, I would have thought we would have at least been entitled to an evidentiary hearing, and the judge would have issued findings of fact, conclusions of law. But all the trial judge did was say there was no fraud. And that was the end of it. And we didn't get a very long hearing at that.
All right, but the court conceivably could have said, well, I see what you're arguing as to due diligence. I find as a matter of law that even accepting what you say is true, as a matter of law, that's not due diligence. So
right.
Maybe explain to me why under the allegations that you've made, there is at least a factual question as to due diligence.
Yeah, there's a number of factual questions. But underlining this is that our ability to maintain a system of justice depends upon having the respect of the people. And I often have mentioned to judges that the second most important thing they can do is judge the case properly. First most important thing is to have the parties believe that they did that. And when you get this kind of a result and the judge doesn't look at it, it has a bad effect upon the respect for the judiciary and our system of laws. And I think that becomes the ultimate victim of all of this.
So Mr. Dubin, what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but what you're saying is that if you had an evidentiary hearing, you would have had the testimony of Ms. Minichino and Mr. Lowe on whether or not this email she claims was sent was received. Because he didn't file a declaration saying he didn't get it, or he didn't file any declaration before the trial court. Is that correct?
That's correct. He seemed to be very careful in how he responded.
So the purpose of the evidentiary hearing would be to find the facts on that issue.
Right.
And perhaps also on whether Ms. Minichino exercised due diligence in looking for the emails during the course of the arbitration.
Right. Now, there's an allegation in the answering brief that somehow my client might be a super genius in the ability to create fake emails. I can assure the court she doesn't have that capability. I don't know who does, but that would certainly be an issue that a court could look at.
Mr. Dubin, in sort of balancing the competing interests, which are finality in arbitration proceedings, and on the other hand, certainly where there are legitimate concerns of fraudulent conduct, where would you set the bar at which point a judge should hold, number one, the evidentiary hearing, and number two, vacate?
In a lot of ways, that's the key issue. Because let's say you have a trial, you have an arbitration, you can't have people come up and say, well, that witness lied, so we're going to go and have another case, another trial, and it would go on forever. I think in these cases in court, the appellate court looks at materiality. And here, what is the key issue in this case? Whether my client terminated based upon the financial contingency clause. That's the key issue.
Right, but that's the key issue before the arbitrator, Mr. Dubin. The key issue before the court was there fraud in the arbitration proceeding? Because I think you're right what you said earlier. The arbitrator can get it completely wrong and make a mistake of fact or a mistake of law, and the courts won't review it. I think the distinction, perhaps in this case, is whether there was fraud in the arbitration proceedings that distinguishes this case from those other situations in which parties seek to vacate an arbitration award.
I remember a couple of years ago there was a decision by this court that pointed out the difference in looking at an arbitration award that was conducted by the parties upon their referral to arbitration, and an arbitration award that came out of a referral from an existing court case that gave the judge special responsibilities because it started out as a judicial proceeding. This case started out as a complaint claiming damages and then asking that the matter be transferred to arbitration. I don't recall the name of that case, but I think this court concluded that the judiciary has a special responsibility when the arbitration comes from the case and then comes back to the court. And I can't understand why if Rule 60 in the state court and Rule 60 in the federal system allows relief from a final judgment based upon even newly discovered evidence, et cetera, which would require a evidentiary hearing and fraud, why in the arbitration context, based upon the language of the statute, the same would not apply. Now, I know in the answering brief there was talk about the difference between extrinsic and intrinsic fraud. And the cases that were cited were rather, some of them were ancient. I noticed that Rule 60 in the state system and also in the federal system eliminates that distinction. Rule 60B3 says fraud, whether heretofore denominated intrinsic or extrinsic.
So your proposal is that, at least as to the issue of whether a judgment or an arbitration can be collaterally attacked based on fraud, that we should apply the same test for the arbitration fraud provision as 60B?
I think by analogy it would make sense to me, especially because the arbitration provision doesn't talk about intrinsic or extrinsic. It just talks about fraud. But again, I think the point is a good one. You know, where do we draw the line? I've had other cases where people come and say, well, this witness lied, and therefore I want to open up the trial again, and there has to be a time when you stop. But here, this was the key issue in the case. Somebody filed a complaint, Mr. Lowe, and said, you didn't close the transaction. He was well aware of the financial contingency. That became the key issue in the case. If, in fact, these emails that are very graphic were received by Mr. Lowe, then I'd have to say that the filing of the complaint, the demand for arbitration, the opposition to vacating the arbitration award, and the opposition to this appeal is really fraud on the court. If, in fact, he got those emails. They're very graphic. I think there were three of them that are in the record. And what do we have? What evidence do we have on the other side? They point to my client and say, you are a licensed real estate broker, so you knew better, and you should have known in reading the stuff that you should have canceled the way you did. As your honors know, a lot of times they point to us attorneys and say, well, we should know better. But the simple fact is that what can you do more than sending emails, and also the emails reference oral conversation, saying, I can't get financing, go get another buyer, I'm sorry, best of luck. Based upon that evidence, I think this would be one of the cases that would fall on the other side of the line, that this would be one of those fact situations. At least the trial judge has an obligation to make inquiry.
And for that proposition, you're relying on the Claussen case, which says whenever material facts are in dispute, in determining whether an arbitration award should be vacated, the circuit court should hold an evidentiary hearing and render findings of facts and conclusions of law.
Yes, I cited that to the trial judge. And it wasn't even recognized.
So at least we should send it back for an evidentiary.
Right. And to me, underlying all this is symptomatically, there's this belief that we're not going to look at what arbitrators do. And I'm, in the other cases before your honors, that's the point I'm pushing, that we have allowed this thing to grow called arbitration. And a lot of injustice is being done. And this should be an area that our appellate courts should put on their agenda. And I think this case really cries out for that.
Just to be really clear, Mr. Dubin, if we did send it back for an evidentiary hearing, what are the factual issues that you contend are in dispute? Go ahead, why don't you tell me?
It would be number one, whether my client exercised due diligence in locating the three emails. Number two, whether or not Mr. Lowe received those emails and failed to inform the arbitrator of that fact. And I presume whether or not, although I think it's clear, whether or not those three emails effectively terminated the transaction. I see I have about 9 minutes left. Perhaps if I could reserve my time.
That's fine.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Still your question?
May it please the court, as you get younger, there are infirmities show up, and one of them is hearing. I have a bad time hearing, so I would appreciate it if the court would.
We'll try to speak up.
Thank you. May it please the court, Gary Gubin, Esquire, attorney for the appellant. May the record show that Maya M. Uyoka is appearing in behalf of the appellee. Now, in this case here, it's undisputed that there was an agreement to buy and sell in 2002. It's undisputed that the appellant was represented by counsel. And it's undisputed that she failed to ask for a postponement of the hearing, which the statute requires. I'll come to that later. And it's undisputed that she failed to tell the arbitrator that there was a fraud. I didn't know anything about it. The appellee didn't know anything about it. But nonetheless, it subsequently came out. Now, an arbitration can be vacated only as provided by statute, and that's 658A.23. And it reads as follows. Now, in the case of Gepaya versus State Farm, 194 Hawaii 362, 2000. An arbitration award is subject to vacation only on the four grounds listed in the appellate statute. And the statute reads as follows, 658A23, vacating award, parenthesis a, small a, and a parenthesis, upon motion to the court by a party to an arbitration proceeding, the court shall vacate an award made in the arbitration procedure if, one, the award was procured by corruption, fraud, or other undue means. Two, there was an evident partiality by an arbitrator appointed as a neutral arbitrator. B, corruption by an arbitrator, or C, misconduct by the arbitrator prejudicing the rights of a party to the arbitration proceeding. Parenthesis three, an arbitrator refused to postpone the hearing upon showing of sufficient cause for postponement, refused to consider evidence material to the controversy, or otherwise conducted the hearing contrary to section 658A-15 so as to prejudice substantially the rights of a party to the arbitration proceeding. Here, the appellant had a right conveyed by the statute, but she had failed to ask for a postponement, and therefore there was a waiver. Now, waiver has been defined.
Mr. Oyoka.
Yes.
But that's an alternative ground. If the petitioner shows any one of those three grounds, they would be entitled to vacate the award. So the fact that a postponement wasn't asked for doesn't preclude the argument that vacating the award should be based upon fraud.
Uh-huh. But that fraud is, what kind of fraud is it?
Well, that's my question.
Extrinsic fraud or intrinsic evidence, you know?
My question to you is, why wouldn't Mr. Lowe affirmatively lying about not receiving the termination notice?
There's an attempt to show that he lied, but the fact that even you show that this email had been supposedly sent by the appellant, questioning whether or not he had received it. There's no evidence that it was received, that he knew about it.
Wouldn't that be an issue of fact, though?
But,
wouldn't that be an issue of fact?
No.
Whether or not he received the email.
Well, it's something that the arbitrator would have to consider at the hearing. It's not afterwards. If it's extrinsic, we agree that it should be vacated. But this is not extrinsic evidence. Extrinsic evidence is whenever a person is prevented from presenting his full case before the arbitrator. And she has a chance to ask for a postponement so that if she couldn't find the email because of the flood, she should have asked, but she didn't. She waived a right that she had under the statute.
Do we have any Hawaii cases that make a distinction? Are there any Hawaii cases that make the distinction between intrinsic an extrinsic fraud?
And there's no Hawaii case that talks about extrinsic fraud and intrinsic evidence. The only case that I came across is the one where Justice Wakatsuki had ruled, but it's not pertinent to the question that we have before this court today. And so there has never been any ruling on extrinsic fraud or intrinsic. That should have been brought up at the hearing before the arbitrator. And although she had the right to ask for a postponement so that she can look around and pretend she had waived her rights. Now, as to whether or not she had waived her rights, it's defined by in the case of Daiichi Real Estate Hawaii versus Lichter. I think that's in 104 Hawaii. And so generally, waiver is defined as an intentional relinquishment of a known right, a voluntary relinquishment of rights, and the relinquishment or refusal to use a right. To constitute a waiver, there must have existed a right claim to have been waived, and the waiving party must have had knowledge, actual or constructive, of the existence of such a right at the time of the purported waiver. In this case here, she's the only one who knew if there were a fraud. She should have asked for a postponement. And if the arbitrator had refused to grant the postponement, there would have been an error. And of course, if the ruling had been against the appellant, she would have had the right to have it vacated according to statute. That's provided by the legislature. It's a right that the legislature, I think, had anticipated the possibility of a situation something like this.
Mr. Uyoka, did the trial court have any declaration from anything from your side about whether a postponement had been asked for? Did you submit anything to the trial court judge about a postponement not being asked?
Yeah. We had never brought that up, but before this argument today, we were bringing it up.
Okay.
So that he had never asked for a postponement. Okay.
That's one of the issues in terms of evidentiary. What did...
Mr. Oka, you got to speak with the mic because recording.
Okay. Yeah.
So no declaration was submitted by your side before the trial court, right?
Yeah.
No testimony to the trial court on those issues.
Well, we did not include that. You know.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh. So we believe that the matter that appellant is claiming should have been brought before the arbitrator before a hearing. It's not a case where she was prevented by us in bringing the matter before the, she has waived the right, and I think a waiver is very important insofar as we're concerned. So we submit that the motion of or the appeal should be denied. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
I don't think I really have anything to add, except there is another alternative to remand in order the thing be sent back to the arbitrator. With the three new emails, I'd like to see what the arbitrator opening up the hearing would conclude, and he'd have the ability to take additional testimony, and that would be probably one additional remedy might be considered.
Mr. Dubin, would you address Mr. Uyoka's argument of waiver, that it should have been brought up before the arbitration hearing if she couldn't find it, if she couldn't find the emails?
She had really plenty of time to locate the emails, and she just simply couldn't find them at that time. So when you go to an arbitrator and say, I want to suspend everything to look for some evidence, when you have no basis to know there's another box that you may have overlooked. Presumably, it's not going to have any effect. Now, I don't know. Yes, I wasn't there. I don't know whether she may have asked for that, in fact, and was denied. There's no evidence in the record that she did or she did not.
Is there any evidence on the record that the award was based on anything other than the determination, the failure to communicate determination? In other words, there's some, assuming arguendo, that it was terminated, the notice was received, that nevertheless there was still a breach of the DROA and the award was supportable on an independent ground?
No. The only thing that's in the finds of fact that I recall was some statement by the arbitrator that there was no evidence presented to support her position. Regarding the issue of waiver, on page 11 of our opening brief, I quoted from Justice Hugo Black in the famous Hazel Atlas Glass Company case, where he points out that surely it cannot be that the preservation of the integrity of the judicial process must always wait upon the diligence of litigants. The public welfare demands that the agencies of public justice be not so impotent that they must always be moot and helpless victims of deception and fraud. The legal system has a responsibility to try to ensure that justice is done in individual cases. And although I appreciate that others may look at this differently, I look at this case as that he waited 2 years, and by the way, talk about waiver, he waited 2 years, and maybe she would have had the, that would have been before the flood, so he waits 2 years, then he sues her, claiming that she didn't close. If I were the judge, I wouldn't need anything more, but I'm not the judge. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement. All right.